Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
Dude, you guys, the dairy producers are no
joke. They don't play?
Oh, no.
Hey, everybody, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in for Marisa Lagos. And today on The Breakdown, Jessica Bartholow has worked behind the scenes at the state capitol for years. She's known for her fierce anti-poverty advocacy and budget expertise, both as a lobbyist and more recently as chief of staff to East Bay State Senator Nancy Skinner.
She recently left the legislature, and I mean really recently, like within a week and a half, to work for SEIU, that is the state's largest and most powerful union. We'll talk with her about the revolving roles she's played inside and outside of state government. But first, Guy, here we are more than a month, almost a month and a half out from the March primary. And still we have a lot of intrigue about the outcome of that race to replace Anna Eshoo for the 16th Congressional District. It started off, oddly enough, with a tie for second place between Assemblyman Evan Lowe and Joe Simidian. And now there's more intrigue.
Right. A historic tie. We thought it would end with that. And three Democrats going to the general election, which would have been a first in our top two era. But no, this continues. There have been two requests for a recount filed in this race spanning between Santa Clara County, San Mateo County. And one of the requesters earlier this week was Jonathan Padilla, who shortly thereafter came out on Twitter and said, "This is who I am. I'm Jonathan Padilla. I've been working in local politics for years." He went through his whole life story. He forgot to mention that he used to work for Sam Liccardo, which is an interesting twist to things. And now we're in this situation where a recount could begin as early as next week. But I think what really caught our eye this week, we've been talking about, is the reaction from the Evan Lowe campaign to this news that there could potentially be a recount moving forward. They came out and said this is a page right out of Trump's political playbook. They accused Liccardo of kind of engineering this behind the scenes. They call it tricks to attack democracy and subvert the will of voters. I think big picture, this is just an interesting question for Democrats in this era of Trump, as they really hone attacks on the former president for his actions to subvert the will of voters and try to overturn the election. We almost end up in this kind of Godwin's Law thing where it's like we're just devolving into all roads lead to talking about Trump. And we even saw some supporters of Evan Lowe who had initially come out and said this, Lorena Gonzalez, head of the California Labor Federation, then walk it back and say, you know what, maybe I should have been more careful with my words.
Yeah, and we also saw a similar kind of situation with Katie Porter when she conceded that she had not been in the top two for the U.S. Senate. And she said the election had been rigged by all the money that poured in to help against her through the cryptocurrency folks and others. And she walked that back because, again, people jumped all over her, Democrats, saying, hey, don't conflate election spending that is, you know, legitimate. You may not like it, but it's not the same as Trump trying to subvert democracy. So it was a lot of blowback and, you know, some little bit of introspection about the how we describe these election outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing because, look, there is a lot of intrigue, unanswered questions about this recount. Where's the money coming from? What's the actual motive for these requesters? But a recount will either illuminate the will of the voters or it will confirm the will of the voters, right? It's hard to imagine what's the scenario where their will be subverted by going back and checking these ballots. So, you know, it's definitely something that I think even beyond the recount, if we end up in a scenario where, let's say, Liccardo and Lowe are in the general election, I don't think this tit for tat it will be quickly forgotten.
So how does this unfold? This dude, Padilla, no relation to Alex Padilla, I assume. His kids are young. So how does he get to decide where the recall counts? This is not like a whole district-wide recall, necessarily.
Well, actually, that's a great question, because in order to change a result, the entire district would need to be recounted. You can't go and say, I want this one precinct to be recounted. Oh, we found an extra ballot for Simidian or Lowe and call it a day. So, and the costs are going to be pretty high for this. I mean, if you talk about the whole district, it could be $400,000 easily to do a manual recount. So where the money is coming from, what the transparency in the money, how that's all going to look, even the day-to-day process, I think, is still questions I have as I, you know, pick a good folding chair to go to the registrar's office on Monday.
So, you know, coming back to what you said at the beginning, that Padilla neglected to mention that he used to work for Sam Liccardo, who came in first. What is there a sense of, like, who would be easier for Liccardo to run against, or, you know, how? I mean, I don't see how anybody would know the likely change that would come if, in fact, the outcome is not confirmed.
Yeah, it seems incredibly difficult to game out this far in advance. I think Liccardo goes into a three-way general election as the favorite. I mean, he bested these two other candidates in the primary. He has raised a lot more money. You know, he has that name ID as being the former mayor of San Jose, and probably will draw more of the moderate and conservative votes who voted for other people, not these three Democrats, in the primary. So I think even he has room to grow, but it's hard to say, like, how a general election would play out. Clearly, Lowe got a lot of support from younger voters. That would give him a large room to gain between now and November. You could make an argument that, you know, Simidian is the last candidate left from his part of the district, closer to Palo Alto. So there's so many scenarios to game out. And also, I think you can't account for the fact that, let's say, Liccardo ends up in a one-on-one race after that. Does the third candidate then say, you know what, I'm going to go out of my way to try to prevent Liccardo from winning? Is there kind of the spite factor as hard to account for at this point in the game?
Well, recalls, of course, are not unprecedented. Is there, you know, a sense to, like, how often is some discrepancy found? Do you have any idea?
I mean, in a case like this where we're literally talking about a tied vote, it's easy to imagine there would be at least one ballot maybe out there, potentially, when you're doing a manual recount and you can see, okay, well, this person, you know, crossed out their name of a candidate, circled another one, made clear their intent, but maybe the machine didn't read that. Something like that perhaps could be picked up.
So no more like curing of any ballots. That's all done. Like, if there was a contested ballot,
right,
could that be brought back?
So here's the question. So the deadline has already passed for voters to have cured their ballot. So the county registrar would have reached out to them and said, hey, your signature doesn't match, or you forgot to sign your ballot envelope. The county registrar has told me it's too late for those voters to change that. But in a recount, all of the materials in an election are subject to review. So is there a world in which one of the campaigns can say this should have never been put in the cure pile to begin with? I mean, those are all...
That's what the lawyers are
this
for.
Yes, the lawyers are eating this week, because there's a lot of open questions going forward in this process.
Somebody ought to be doing a documentary film about this. All right, we are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Jess Bartholow, who recently left a big job in state government to work for SEIU, the most powerful labor union in California. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, here with Guy Marzorati, and today we're happy to have with us a woman whose name you might not recognize, but who has played an important role for the past 25 or so years. Jess Bartholow worked as an advocate for low-income Californians at the Western Center for Law and Poverty for a few years, then as chief of staff for East Bay Senator Nancy Skinner, and now she's got a new job heading up government affairs for SEIU, that is the largest union in California. Jess Bartholow, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thanks, Scott. Good to see you too, Guy.
Thanks for coming in. Well, let's start with a little bit of news. Of course, the state is facing a budget deficit, and the legislature today approved a package of kind of what they're calling early action to try to reduce that deficit by $17 billion. First of all, you know, what's your general take? You worked for Senator Skinner, who once chaired, I think, the budget committee, right? So tell us, you know, what do you see as the legislature kind of moves on this, try to get a handle on the deficit early?
That's right. They just voted on the early action package. This was a package of things that the senators, the assembly members, and the governor could agree on early. Kind of might be described as the easier conversations, saving some of the harder conversations for later. But it should be noted that there it's a long list. If you haven't seen it, it's a lot of people say, oh, it's not a transparent process. It's very transparent. There's a nice list. It's been up for about a week and a half on the Senate budget website and for at least a week on the Assembly. And you can take a look at it. And that list of things that will be delayed or no longer be pursued through budget investments are people's hopes, dreams, organizing. A lot of work and effort went behind trying to get those in the budget, and they'll be paused for now. So those are, to some people and to some communities and to some Californians, real cuts, and they'll be feeling it. We still have a lot of conversation ahead, and as I said before, the harder conversation is yet to come.
Yeah, I've had a hard time thinking about the shortfall this year because on one hand, it doesn't seem like, you know, the economy is not cratering. You don't have this huge demand for public assistance programs that maybe you saw during the Great Recession. At the same time, you talk about a number like $70 billion. I mean, that doesn't seem like a number you can just shift some money around, play the ballpark hat game, and suddenly end up with a balanced budget. So how bad of a situation do you feel like we're in?
Well, listen, budgets play themselves out in kind of three-year windows, and we're looking at a three-year window that does look better over the next 3 years. We're going to have a couple of hard years this year and next where we have to adjust for what we expected to have and what we actually have. So this isn't a recession-driven deficit that we've had in the past. 2008, 2009, 2010, when I first started at Western Center on Law and Poverty, I'd come up out of the anti-hunger movement, and the proposals on the table then were end the CalWORKs program. Schwarzenegger proposed ending an entire program serving low-income families with children. We had desperate calls from the community. This is nothing like that. And we had people losing their jobs right and left and people losing their homes. This isn't that. This was a miscalculation.
So several of this, you know, billion-dollar early savings is shifting from the general fund to some other state accounts, some revenue. And to a lot of people, that looks a little bit like smoke and mirrors. Republicans are saying it's gimmicky. That's something that Democrats accused Arnold Schwarzenegger of in the past. Why are Republicans wrong about that?
Listen, the budget is big and it's complicated. And I know the people who work on the budget day in and day out, and they are earnest and sincere in trying to create a budget and a budget document everybody can agree on, and that's honest. And I think people kind of rush to the term gimmicky when they don't understand it or they feel like they haven't been at the table. And I do think it's a mischaracterization. People are working really hard to get at good budget solutions for California.
As an advocate, how do you go into a year like this? I mean, the needs, the long-term needs don't necessarily change, but how kind of the game planning or strategy, how does that change when you're engaging with lawmakers in a year like this where you know the number?
Well, we know the number, right? We also know what's happening out in the community. And this is really all about Californians, real Californians that go to work every day to try to pay their rent, make sure they have food on the table. And the most important thing is to continue to tell their stories. You can't shy away from telling the legislature what they need and bringing people to the Capitol to articulate that need. Now, a lot of times you hear pushback, that's fine. People need support for this or that. How are you going to fund it? And we remind the legislatures that the average person in California, it's not their job to figure out how to fund it. And you know what? While we're talking about funding things, we should be looking at some of the tax credits that big corporations are getting, the loopholes. We should be looking at options for revenue, and those need to be on the table too, not just austerity. We learned from the Great Recession that austerity doesn't work.
Yeah, people sometimes forget that tax credits are a revenue cost. I mean, they're not free, even though they sometimes get handed out like candy.
That's right. Governor
Newsom, relatedly somewhat to all this, is calling on state workers to stop working from home or whatever hybrid situation they might have, come back into the office. He was pushed to do that in part by the mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg. What are your thoughts? SEIU is pushing back, saying, hey, this is going to, not SEIU, but, it was a local SEIU, not the statewide group. But, you know, they're saying, hey, we're going to have to pay for commuting and parking, and we might have to buy some new clothes because we're not going to be on Zoom. Is that what do you make of that argument?
Yeah, SEIU Local 1000 is a really important one of our 17 locals, and their workforce making up part of our 700,000 workers across the state are concerned about this, and their costs for commuting in are real. Parking, the drive, the extra time away from family and community. These are all real things and should be considered, and we know that they're communicating directly to the governor's office about that. More broadly, you know, I think it's important to remember that a lot of our workforce, they've been in the office or the workplace every single day. They were there while all of us were home during COVID. They helped to take care of us at the hospitals and the clinics. They helped to feed us through the fast food when we didn't want to go inside any place, but we didn't want to cook at home. You know, the lunch workers at our schools, etc. These people have been going to work every day, and it's important to think about them as well and remember that some people never got to stay home.
We want to shift a bit to talk about you and the path that led to this incredible career you've had at the state capitol. Tell us a little bit about your childhood. I understand you moved around quite a bit as a kid.
We're from California. I always say my family moved here for the gold rush and we didn't leave. I even grew up panning for gold. My dad would take us to the river and we'd pan.
Really? Like in gold country?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
And was that for fun or like looking for gold because you needed the money?
Well, yeah.
Both.
Yeah, and my dad's a Vietnam vet. He was a Vietnam vet. He's dead now. But it was the forest and the mountains and the hills were a place where he and a lot of veterans go to just find solace and be away and could find some mental health and peace there. So we spent a lot of time in the mountains. I'm from Northern California, and we did move around a lot. You read my bio, I always say it didn't start at Western Center. I grew up poor. Me and my sister, my dad was a veteran. My mom worked as a bookkeeper until she was arrested for fraud, check fraud, and perhaps stealing from her employer when we couldn't make the rent.
Wow. How old were you when that happened?
I was 12. And she disappeared for a couple days and didn't have money for bail. We didn't have a phone at the house. We didn't have electricity. We were in real crisis. And my mom, she always worked, and my dad worked when he could. So we know what it's like to have to try to make ends meet and not be able to go to work hungry, to go to work even when you're being harassed or fondled or abused. And still have to go there because you don't have a choice.
You know, some people come out of a situation like that. Well, and there's all kinds of different reactions. I mean, they never quite get on track in some cases, or they excel and get, you know, very wealthy. You know, you've chosen to kind of advocate for the people who your family was that you just described. How did you come to that decision?
That wasn't easy. I didn't want to. You know, America, the U.S., we tell poor people they're poor because it's their fault. And when you grow up in that environment, it's really hard not to believe it. And I believed it. And I was ashamed. I didn't want to be seen around my mom or my dad. And after my sister dropped out of school, not her either, I wanted to get out of town, and I didn't want to turn back. And it took me some time. I went here in Mills College in the East Bay, and I didn't realize, I was just a babe in the woods. I didn't know what I didn't know. And that was the first time I met people in the middle class and wealthy people. I learned how to eat with more than one fork, you know. And I went on and I thought, well, maybe I can escape this poverty. When I went to college, my family went homeless and I lost them for a little while. We kind of all spread everywhere. And it took me a while to come back to them and recognize their humanity and over time my humanity. And it wasn't until I was in graduate school that I was recruited out by a union organizer, Ruth Shai. She was part of the movement to establish the UFW, United Farm Workers, and taught me how to be an organizer. And from there, to learn that the most important thing about being an organizer and an activist is to listen to the people. And I found hope and community and love and in them, and that helped me see myself in a new light. Mm-hmm. And so it's not even a consideration that I would ever go anyplace else. It is working with people fighting for their rights every day that I love being in that space. And that's why I'm so excited to be at SEIU now.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, I'm sure in your decades of work, you spend a lot of time talking to Californians, California families experiencing poverty, experiencing maybe some of the things that your family went through. But I'm wondering if there's things that you hear that are different over the years. I mean, maybe a better way of asking this is, like, how have you seen poverty change in California from when you were a kid to now?
Yeah, I mean, something I think that is really important about the conversation that we're having today is people are understanding more and more how impactful race and gender is in who is poor, who remains poor, who is criticized when they organize for their own power. And I think that that is a really, that's something that's changed over time, even within the time period that I was an organizer and now am at the Capitol.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Guy Marzorati, and our guest today is Jess Bartholow. Until recently, she was chief of staff to East Bay State Senator Nancy Skinner. She just joined SEIU, that is the largest union in California, as head of government affairs. So you've been on both sides. You've been an advocate, as you just described. You then chose to go work inside in the legislature. Two questions. Well, like, why did you decide to make that change? And what did you learn on the outside that you brought with you on the inside and maybe now are going to take with you back to SEIU?
Yeah, I never saw myself going inside at all. I like I said before, I love being with the people. I love supporting their organizing and helping them fight power at the Capitol. And I had been asked many times to come on inside. But when Nancy Skinner, during the pandemic, called and said she needed the chief of staff and she wanted to be budget chair. And remember, we were all at home and on our Zooms during the pandemic, and it became harder and harder to figure out how to make an impact on the inside. So when she called and said she was aiming to be budget chair in the Senate run by Toni Atkins, who herself grew up poor and is a well-known feminist and leader of women, I couldn't help but want to do that. She called before the election, though, and I had been leading work here in California and across the country with many low-income people stepping up to fight against the Trump food stamp cuts. These were people who were homeless, people who had nothing, who said, yes, sign me up. I will sue President Donald Trump. These were the bravest people you could have ever imagined. And I was so proud to be supporting them in that effort. And so I told her I wouldn't come in unless Trump lost. I had to keep going as hard as it was to keep fighting against the Trump food cuts. And she called me a couple of days after the election and she said, welcome to Team Skinner. Mm. It has been an incredible ride. She is everything you here in the Bay Area and in the East Bay in particular know about her. She's a hard fighter. She works diligently and tirelessly.
Yeah, I was going to ask. She's going into her last summer in the legislature after 14 years in the Assembly and the Senate representing the East Bay. What's her legacy?
Oh, wow. I mean, we don't have enough time in the program. Some of the things I'm the most excited about is, you know, she was the first in the country to get a bill passed in partnership with Gavin Newsom and Pro Tem Atkins for universal school meals. And this has started a movement, not just here in the country, but internationally. There's now hundreds of nations signed up for universal school meals. We were the first. Now 9 states have it. 22 states have introduced. The president has said he wants to do it nationally. She should be proud of that. Her deincarceration, we've been able to close some prisons and we're closing more. That's a lot because of the reforms that she's led. And I think those would be two things I would really lift up.
You know, we talked with a former member of the legislature who said that, you know, Governor Jerry Brown didn't really understand what it was like to grow up poor because he didn't. Governor Newsom kind of did. His mom was on food stamps at one point. But I'm wondering, how do you see the difference between those two governors and how they look at the social safety net?
Yeah, I mean, they are really radically different. Let me just say first about Gavin Newsom. When he ran for governor, he said, my North Star will be poor children. And he has held true to that promise. I felt very challenged as an advocate to come forward with an agenda that would hold him true to that. And he's delivering. So I've been really proud and honored to be part in partnership with him on that. We should all be proud. Jerry Brown, he was brilliant. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. And the kinds of questions he would bring forward for us as advocates, they would be questions we'd never even thought of. You know, 15 years on a campaign, and he comes with this question that's just changes the game and would pull us into the table in different kind of ways. I became a better advocate because of him, and we should all, I think, you're right. He didn't understand poverty, but he did understand systems, and he understood government. And so we saw a lot of good things happen under his leadership as well.
So you are now joining SEIU as Director of Government Relations. This is like the legislative version of when Kevin Durant joined the Warriors. Like, they've had a huge success recently. The organized labor had a big year in the legislature last year. So what are you bringing to the table, and what's left to accomplish in your mind?
Yeah, I think it is a moment right now for SEIU California and SEIU nationally, just to say, you know, SEIU has a different vision for labor organizing. It's engaging people who some never thought could be organized. And to not just gain worker power, but our members are really excited about improving everything about the lives and the communities that they live and the people that they live with. And so that's a beautiful vision, and I'm really excited to be part of that. I think you're referencing some victories that we had on minimum wage recently for the
fast food workers
yeah. And also healthcare workers. A little bit later this year, we'll be working to implement those $25 an hour for healthcare workers as well. A lot of our agenda this year is implementation. We want to get this right. And, you know, these are sectoral victories where these workers are winning minimum wage for themselves. This is just the beginning. Hmm. We do see this as being a wave that we hope will increase the wages of everybody across California and hopefully inspire other states to do the same. The federal minimum wage is disgraceful. And we really hope that this is a movement that's inspiring other states.
There's a lot of pushback, of course, from business where they say, well, look, we're just going to pass these costs along to consumers. You know, it's going to cost more for a double-double at In-N-Out or whatever. What do you think of that argument?
There is nobody out there who isn't already seeing those increases in costs. They're going to blame low-income workers of color for their victories, for costs that they've already been increasing. There was a recent report out there just over the weekend reposted that shows that costs have been increasing for the past, you know, half a decade. We all know this. Don't tell me you don't notice. And it's not a surprise that billionaires will blame poor people for that, but that's what they're doing.
Real quick, we're almost out of time. You have a son, I think, named Cal. Is that Cal, as in California?
Yeah, their dad ran track for Cal, and he's a teacher, so he knows all kinds of names and didn't like them, any name I came up with. So I said, what about Callan? And we can call him Cal, and the other kid's name is Oski. So yes, Cal and Oski are from Calbert.
Nice. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us, Jess Bartholow.
Really appreciate it.
Really appreciate it, and sharing, you know, everything you did with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. That's a wrap for Thursday, April 11th. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED.
Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Izzy Bloom. I'm Guy Marzorati.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.